We join John Gatto in his lecture entitled The Guerrilla Curriculum, Already in Progress.
And therefore, in no single decision of your life, if an expert's available, should you not avail yourself of that person's services? Well, if that's true for us, who have been trivialized and made childlike, certainly since the end of the Second World War, then it's true in spades for your kids and my kids and all the kids out there. So I'm here to contradict that with a little bit of documentary evidence. I want to confess that is not well prepared and strategically arranged. Over the course of being a junior high school teacher in Manhattan, living in an apartment, there's no space to store anything, and I'll tell you that the conflicts come thick and fast. They never stop. There's never a boat ride. So whatever documentation I have here sort of accidentally survived my transit through the world. However, why don't you look at some of it? Some of this is my kids, and some of it's stuff I use to goose my kids into action. I'm going to need a media expert to turn that machine on. Let's start with a 17-year-old girl who was thrown out of six New York City schools for being wretched. Impossible. A 17-year-old girl whose father approached her. He was a minor artist in New York City. He had a few bucks. He was not rich by any means. But he said, it would cost me $60,000 to send you to college, and I have a check for $60,000 in my hand, and I'm going to give it to you. I want you to move out of the house immediately, and I don't care what you spend this money for. Buy drugs, I don't care, he said. On the other hand, he said, I'm prepared to buy you a 26-foot boat. It's much more than 26 feet from me to that camera. A 26-foot boat if you will sail it around the world alone. Now, mind you, this girl was working as a bicycle messenger in Manhattan. She's like one of these kamikaze bikes that go in and out of the truck, deliver packages. She'd been thrown out of six schools. She had no background as a nautical woman. And obviously, when she did take the necessary navigation courses to be allowed to sail out of New York Harbor, she cheated. The first American woman to circumnavigate the globe alone. That's not ancient history. That's about 7 or 8 years ago. A bicycle messenger who cheated on her navigation test. How did she learn to navigate? There's some heavy-duty mathematics. Well, she tells it, and I have no reason not to believe this is true. The generator went out about 30 or 40 nautical miles from Bermuda, and a hurricane was coming up. I mean, 20, 30, 40-foot waves. And she knew that if she missed Bermuda, there's nothing beyond it at all, and she would certainly be dead. There was no one on the boat. She couldn't call anybody by telephone. She said, I sat there with an electric torch and the navigation books, and I figured out how to get that thing into Bermuda Harbor. She had a cat on the boat. And 2 years later, she had sailed around the world alone, met a Danish kid doing the same thing. They got married. They live in Brooklyn Heights, New York. Say hello for me if you drop over. Now, at the same time, same general time, the beginning of the 1980s, the beginning of the 1980s, a third grade dropout named George Meegan, he's a ratty looking guy in the lower left hand corner, he was the lowest ranked sailor on a tramp steamer crossing to South America, but he had this dream that he would walk from Tierra del Fuego to Point Barrow, Alaska. He would walk from the South Pole to the North Pole, as close as you can walk. He had no magnesium frame backpack. He had no freeze-dried food. He had no Adidas sneakers. He didn't have anything. I think he had a map there, and he jumped ship in Chile, got his way to Tierra del Fuego, and 7 years later, I think in 1980 or 79, he arrived at the North Pole with his family. He had met and married a Japanese girl along the way, and they had two kids. He had walked 20,000 miles. Now, I know a skeptic in this audience is saying, but it's not 20,000 miles. It's only 13,000. That's true. But when they crossed into Texas, he said, I've always wanted to see Washington, D.C. So they detoured 7,000 miles and saw the Capitol, like I'm sure many of you have done. Now, if you open the newspaper, this is the last class newspaper. I didn't use photocopy. This was originally printed on newsprint. And it came out, I would guess, 4 or 5 times a year, irregularly. But this is the last issue that I did before the school district got on my case. And I said to myself, even though I live in an apartment, I think I ought to preserve this, because one day when I'm telling people what kids are capable of doing, people are going to say, yeah, it's easy to talk. But it's not so easy. If you look on page 2, to ignore the fact that this 13-year-old girl you see booked an appointment for herself at the evening speak-out at the New York Board of Education, and she spoke for 12 minutes actively berating the commissioners of New York schools that she had just made $3,000 or $4,000 in 5 weeks cutting class and running a business, and that nothing in any curriculum in any school, including Stuyvesant, had anything to do with a job being anything other than what someone gives you for good behavior. She said the principles of American life lead people to independent livelihoods, and here you're holding me for 12 years and I broke out, and I'm here to tell you that you're doing a wrong and a bad thing. So that's B.J. Cummings, teen businesswoman slams Board of Ed on unrealistic curriculum. The year there is, I think it's 1980 or 81. Now I'd like you to look at B.J. Cummings as of 1991, 11 years later. She had dropped out of college. By the way, B.J. was, as you can see in the photograph, a white young woman, very fair complexion, who grew up in Harlem. Why she did that was not because her family was ultra-liberal, but the father was gone, and the mother couldn't afford to live anyplace else, so that's where they grew up. I asked her several times whether that had had a horrifying effect on her development, and she said that she hardly even noticed it. Anyway, here's B.J. 11 years later. B.J. drops out of college in her freshman year, teaches herself Portuguese, hitchhikes to Brazil. Well, how do you do that? I guess you go to Miami, you go to airports around there, and you talk some private pilot who's going down there anyway into taking you, and apparently thousands of people do this. I mean, it's another one of the great secrets. She gets to the Amazon. She goes up the Amazon to an Indian village where the culture is being destroyed by the recent construction of a dam. And she writes a book in 7 weeks called Damn the Rivers, Damn the People, about the political use of dams and other monumental construction you know, to pay off the right people, irrespective of the harm they do. The World Wildlife Foundation picked it up. I believe it's translated into 7 languages. Out of the book, she gets a free PhD from, I think, UCLA Berkeley, but one of the colleges down there. She just got married about a year ago, and when she came to Carnegie Hall to speak, the year that I quit teaching, Pat Ferengo was one of the speakers. She came to Carnegie Hall and she said, "I can't stay for the party afterwards because I'm lecturing in Bermuda about her specialty," which very few people have, so the effect of dam building on traditional cultures. Hey, that was BJ. I'd like to show you some more of this because what we're working on is to what extent you can trust people that we call children, and I believe wrongly so. We've invented the culture of childhood, and we impose it. I think the shortfall is very, very large. I'm trying to respect the fact someone's tape recording this for whatever reason, I don't know. Surely not to sell these tapes. Okay. If you come to the talk tomorrow morning I'm giving, you'll hear me say glancingly that I made the structure of schooling the central academic study that we did. I was desperate to declassify children, or to have them declassify themselves, and I knew that could not take place as long as they would leave my room or the activities that I allowed and go back into the culture that told them who they were and what they could do and what numbers they had to display when they wanted to do them. So one of the ways, this is an illustration of one of the ways that without preaching, I was able to attack the assumptions of schooling. Now, there isn't a person here or a person alive who hasn't at one time or another said, why do I have to ask permission to go to the toilet there? And furthermore, I would tell the kids that, you know, that when I'm in the middle of one of these ranting expositions, I don't want to be interrupted with some request to go to the toilet, because I'll turn on you like a wild dog and humiliate you, and I'll discuss your privates and everything else. On the other hand, I had a standing offer. I said, you can go to the toilet when you want to. All you have to do is take, what you can't see here is that there's a hood too that goes on it. You put the toilet pass on, and then I said, if you want to make your own toilet pass out of an old sheet, you can just come to look like the Ku Klux Klan meeting, but you can go to the toilet wherever you want to go. There it is. Toilet activity was extremely limited in my class, but not because I prevented it. Wait, I'm desperate to put this back in the envelope it belongs to, or otherwise. All right. In a city like Boston, and I really almost hate to say this, because the truth is, in the simplest country town, there are innumerable valuable things for kids to participate in as citizens. I mean, not as kids. But my imagination's been tempered in cities, and Boston certainly qualifies as one of those. There are constantly public meetings in cities. Usually they're pro forma, that is, the decision's already been made, but citizens are invited to make a presentation of their point of view. That's an infinite number of opportunities for your kids, in fact, not as good little kids, but as people, to bring some information to the attention of important people, and furthermore, to develop this cast iron personality where you're not afraid to speak in any setting, and you know how to organize information. So let me tell you this hesitation is not caused by Alzheimer's, it's caused by thinking about whoever's recording this. I wish I didn't have to do this. When I arrived in New York City from Pittsburgh, I saw immediately the differences between a city that was organized in large part by its people for its people, to a city that was organized by elite groups who may have meant well by people but really didn't understand their needs. So that swimming, which is pathetically easy to do in Pittsburgh, far out of reach of, you know, any body of water that you'd want to be in, opportunities to do that were abundant, whereas in New York City, with the ocean lapping, I mean, nobody swims in New York City, and the public swimming pools had been reduced to 5. Fortunately, one of those 5 public swimming pools was very close to one of the schools I worked in, and I was constantly looking for some official way to get masses of kids out of the building. That's the hard thing. Once they're out of the building, whether they went swimming or not, I didn't care. But a lot of them did go swimming, in fact. So I said, well, I don't want to waste this time just having fun there. So I went up to Columbia, and I got kids on the swimming team to come down and give lessons to those who wanted them. But in any case, an announcement was made about 10 years ago that all the public swimming pools were going to be closed because of a budgetary constraint, and anyway, nobody used them. That meant, by the way, and you would not be able to guess what political party I belong to, if what I'm going to say here, but that nobody used them meant that no upper middle class white kids used them, because plenty of people used these swimming pools, but they they didn't record on the instrumentation of the New York Times. Which approved of the closures. So I made a standing offer to any kid in the school that if they were willing to go through a crash course in public presentation, that I was willing to let them sign up and go down to City Hall and stand in these august chambers and make their case, one right after another, which precipitated a crisis at the hearing, by the way, because it turned out about 15 kids had signed up using their right to claim 3 or 4 minutes at time, and the chairman, who was only marking time, I'm telling you, all these hearings, the decision's been made ahead of time. You know, it's to let you ventilate. It was too impatient to let them speak, at which point we got tough with the city commissioners. Anyway, one after another.
Simon Ginsberg, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Is it true that you want to close our neighborhood swimming pool because you think not enough people use the pool? The reason more people do not use the swimming pool is because 9 out of 10 West Siders have no idea there is a swimming pool on West 59th Street. Marissa DeMar, I'm representing the young citizens, the West 86th Street neighborhood. Oh, no, that was somebody else. Good afternoon. My name is Israel Paniaga. I'm here today representing the teenage swimmers. You want us to swim in the Hudson River or in Central Park Lake? That would get pretty cold in the fall, winter, and spring. Instead of closing the pool some days, we need more days, and on. I have pages of these people appearing. I don't know what effect this had, just as I'm afraid I do know what effect the girls had on the Beatles Memorial in Central Park, but the swimming pools were not closed. They were not closed. And nobody else of any effectiveness was at the hearings to speak for the swimming pools, because we all knew it was
foregone conclusion. You'll hear me refer tomorrow, if you come to the talk in the morning, to a girl who constantly tossed her long blonde hair. I mean, hundreds of times an hour. I'm sure you've seen women like that. Somehow or other, they just cannot keep the hair out of their eyes. And I had noticed that she had, at all times, 100% of the male attention in the class, including mine. I also knew that there wasn't a girl in the classroom who wouldn't cheerfully cut her throat. So I decided to defuse this hostility toward Caitlin. And I asked Caitlin, I said, listen, we have to make the subject, if it's agreeable to you, the subject of your tossing your hair, an intellectual exercise in the classroom. There, we have to examine it sociologically, whether or not there isn't some device that might keep the hair out of your eyes and you healthy. Let me show you Caitlin. Was Caitlin a model when the incident I'm talking to you about happened? No. Caitlin extracted a price for allowing herself to be used as the subject of the academics in the classroom. She said, I want 3 weeks out of school, and I don't want it to show on any school record. She said, and I'm going to figure out how you get a job as a cover model. I said, Caitlin, not a cover model. I mean, it's $2,000 an hour range. I said, if you do it as a catalog model or something humble and make the information available to other kids, you got a deal. Well, somebody was wrong, because there you see not only that cover, but this cover. There's many, many. Caitlin's a lawyer today. Whether she paid her own way through law school, I do not know, but I do know this, that her mother, who approved of the project strictly on the grounds that she was 100% certain that Caitlin had no opportunity whatsoever to get this, had booked her into a youth camp in Poland during the communist years that summer, and there certainly was some bad blood between us. It was unintentional there. The hottest nightclub in New York City for the last few years has been the New Eurekan Poets Cafe. The New Eurekan Poets Cafe was literally built and put together by a former student of mine and now a very, very close friend, Roland Lajardi Lara. He's been written about all over the world. The cafe is a phenomenal place where every Friday there's an original play written by some member of one of New York's minority communities. Every Saturday, there's a poetic competition where the audience votes victory or destruction. And every Tuesday, an original film script is acted out by the best actors in New York City. I mean, people that you've seen all over the place. All that was put together by a boy and several other people without parents, without any inheritance at all, who lived for a number of years after he got out of school, kind of like pickup. I mean, he'd sleep in somebody's loft and somebody else's loft and somebody else's loft. At the age of 34, he was earning $3.50 an hour as a CETA poet. That was a government program that brought poets into schools, and I can tell you, I witnessed several of the encounters between New York City school children and poets, and they're not, you can't describe them in mixed company. That's it. Okay, there you see Roland in the upper right-hand corner, and you see his first film. He comes to me at 34, and he says, I want to make a film. I say, well, you've never shown any interest in film at all. You don't even have a still camera. He says, I know, but I've just discovered that the national sport of Nicaragua is poetry. And I want to make a film called Nicaragua, Land of Poets. I said, you can't even pay the rent. You're going to make a film that should cost, I don't know, $400,000 about poets? I said, can you imagine anybody buying a ticket to that film? If you made it, what would you do with it? But I gave him $50 because on a school teacher's income, that was the maximum extent. And I drove him to the airport. He got a ticket to Nicaragua. Drove him to the airport, dropped him off at like 6:30 in the morning, and about 4 months later he was back with a whole bunch of stills of washerwomen and soldiers all declaiming poetry to each other. And I said, if this is really true, it's as revolutionary a thing as I've ever heard. I mean, Nicaragua isn't even a country that people can spell, let alone no one wants to go there. As sharks in the freshwater lake, and these people are all poets. They have no wealth, they have no tradition of fine culture, and they're all poets. And he says, yes. He raised $400,000, he won 9 film awards with it, and his next project was the New Eurekan Poets Cafe. And right now, he and I have raised together $400,000, we're $800,000 short of making a series of films about schooling in the United States, a 3-part series. So that's what I'll do when I leave here. I'll go and worry. But how was Roland in class at 13? Well, he hardly ever was in class at 13. He was everywhere that poets were. He told me that at 13, that he would never wear a necktie in his life, and he never has. Never wear a necktie in his life, and that he was going to make his living as a poet. Jeez, and what do you say to a kid like that? Lots of luck? I mean, high-paid poets get $5 a poem, you know. there's absolutely no market for it there. Well, I'm wrong. Here are some things that I'm really surprised don't show up more, but I'm sure they will in homeschooling communities. One of the best ways to bond kids together, and I guess in Boston here, Pat did something, or a lot of you did something with P.G. Wodehouse, a play, and Pat played the piano, but I constantly, I mean, it wasn't a year. It wasn't a year that I didn't put together, and I didn't do it, you know, some kid producer would put together, on the strength of being free of schooling for as long as they needed to be, put together a traveling talent show. Where do you get audiences for a traveling talent show? You can't beat them off with a stick. There are all the old age homes, there are hospital wards, there are first, second, and third graders who love to watch slightly older kids sing, dance, juggle, declaim, and then sit around with those kids and learn how to do that themselves. So this was a standard of the last 10 years of my teaching. I mean, my talent teams were moving around New York City, booking themselves in, and every once in a while I would stick an oar in to make sure. You know, I would always insist on, if I tell you that I don't believe I don't believe childhood exists past, I don't know, the age of 7, 8, 9, somewhere. Probably you play it by ear with your own kid. So if people are out there demanding the time or attention of the community, then they owe the community something. I mean, it's a reciprocity. It's not one way. Look at another thing that was a constant in my classrooms that certainly would be the easiest thing in the world to do if you're willing to get up at 2 a.m. in the morning. Now, the kids I had were 13, so they couldn't drive, so I had an old station wagon, and I would meet them at 2 a.m., and we would end up an hour later at the Bronx Terminal Market, which easily is the most dangerous single place in the United States. I mean, you're in the middle of not only an utter wasteland with lots of strange people wandering around, because there's stuff coming in and out from all over the country every day, and you know, you grab some of it, it's dark. But I'll tell you this, when I broached the idea to some kids, I said, I think you can make real money doing this. They said, no one will sell wholesale to kids. I said, why don't you just try somebody with money in your hand and see whether they care what age you are. I mean, a little baby could crawl up and hold on, he'd get the radishes too. So I started it off in the simplest fashion by demonstrating that it could invigorate the life of a school. Now the school was highly resistant, but I said, okay, we'll just use checkout time one day a week and just run it for like 25 minutes there. Well, the first time we ran it, there were three boys involved. Each made net $30 after paying me for my driving time. Each made 30 bucks a piece. I had put up the original stake to buy the stuff. But a lot of teachers were furious with me because they had left a little bit late, and there weren't any of these fresh fruits and vegetables left when they got there. The kids were able to sell them 20-30% cheaper than the market, but the difference is they were one day old, and the markets are all, the fresh stuff you buy is cold storage. It's 6, 7, 8, 9 weeks old. So here you're selling a superior product at less money cost and providing an excellent revenue for three young entrepreneurs. I said, I'm not going to get up at 2 a.m. all the time, but I'll bet you can find a building custodian who knows when the last tenant goes to sleep, who'll be happy to run you up, and do the, if you can do the turnaround in a couple hours there, which happened. One of these boys who originally started this is a manager of a restaurant now down in the South Street Seaport. And one of them, this is amazing. One of them is one of these billionaire vitamin hustlers who runs these hard sell ads on the radio. And you know, there's some earnest interview with someone who says, right, you know, I got rid of everything, my ugliness, my cancer, it all happened. Really, my kids. Okay. Let me see if there are any here that are... I want to show you some of the range of things that are possible that seem to me very possible in the Boston area. This was an absolute winner. Yeah. Okay, Manhattan's broken into, I don't know, 30 or 32 zip code zones. And to most of us, that's just a slight extra burden when you're addressing envelopes. But in fact, a huge part of the marketing business depends on knowing the human characteristics of the people in a zip code zone, and you can buy certain zip code zones, and you'll pay through the nose for ones in which people, for example, have made a purchase by mail in the last 30 days from a zip code zone. You pay a lot, but what you're getting is prime suckers who've already revealed, you know, what their weakness is. I thought about that for a long time. I was looking for ways to break the urban fear of moving by your own legs and feet, you know, that you gotta wait for a bus or a subway in New York City there. And I was looking for some way to provide a rationale for actually what I wanted the kids to do was to walk all over Manhattan. It's 12 miles long, it's about 2 miles wide. It's not a very difficult thing to master Manhattan. When I came from Pittsburgh to Columbia University, I used to set aside a street like Broadway, and I would walk from, you know, like 180th Street on Broadway all the way down to the Staten Island Ferry on Saturday, and then I would shift over to something like 6th Avenue and pick it up at 59th Street and walk the length of it. I wanted to know every street of my city. When I'd go to the baseball game at Yankee Stadium, it was 9 miles away. That's not a very long walk. And by walking there, you pass through these changing neighborhoods. So I realized in a very, very short time that I knew considerably more about New York City than the people I knew who had grown up there and had a life in it, because they would only travel on tracks or in vehicles. And the city is much constrained when you do that. Well, so this project was to pass through the different zip code zones, and it took quite a long time, with the knowledge of what the median income in the zip code zone was, and trying to see how a difference in $1,000 or $2,000 a year median income turns out in shop windows, in the way people dress, in the housing, in the cleanliness of the streets. It's quite incredible the tiny differences show up. And if any of you know the famous American sociologist Jenks, Christopher Jenks, wrote a blockbuster book about schools in 1964 called Inequality, in which he maintained that the difference of $1,000 a year in income makes a radical difference in the culture of the family. And when I was disposed to throw that out right away, suddenly it dawned on me that just $1,000 a year would mean that the young lady could have 3 party dresses a year, and maybe the guy, the kid, the boy could go to a baseball game 4 or 5 times, that the family might be able to eat out once a month instead of never eating out. Except at McDonald's, they might be able to have a subscription to the local newspaper. It is a vast difference at a time. Jenks correlated it with scores on the SAT exams, and he said it is an absolute positive correlation. That you add $1,000 in income, he says, you can count on, I forget what the chunk of points is, you can count on this. You can just bank that information. So I wanted the kids to experience that in person without preaching, but also I wanted them to be aware of one of the many vast ways to make a living that are utterly invisible to people who really aren't coached. If you know that the marketing industry exists in your early teens, or even before that, you know how you're manipulated. You know why that suddenly in September all the clothing is purple, or the left sleeve is 4 inches longer than the right sleeve. You can see the people making these decisions, hiring the Beatles or whoever their flacks are, to peddle this as if it were some natural expression of First Amendment rights, and to milk it for as much boodle as you can get, and then you do it again, and you can do it endlessly as long as people are unaware that they can be manipulated that way. The minute they're aware, it's much, much harder to manipulate them. I have lots of other things here, but I'm going to stop right after I show you Victor. Right after I show you Victor. Victor, hello. That's Victor. Did they give you Victor's resume? It would knock your socks off. This is a 14-year-old kid who never ate off a tablecloth in his life, who was listed in the school records as a criminal, I mean, just open and shut, had a list of police charges against him a mile long. This is a boy who was hired as a television producer at the age of 15 when he presented his resume of what he had done. Master of Ceremonies at Carnegie Hall. He had been an advisor to Senator Kerry in his presidential run for the Democratic nomination, the one that Clinton got. He was a personal friend of Deborah Winger. I mean, it just went on and on and on, because Victor never came to school. And there you see Victor in white tie and tails. He arrived at Carnegie Hall. As usual, he didn't know his part. And I grabbed Victor and I said, "Victor, your mother's going to be out there and she is going to be humiliated. I don't have time to holistically show you something about standing on a stage in the most awesome theater, probably in the world. I mean, it's just unbelievable. The seats climb up at a very, very steep pitch. So the whole room is there when you're there." I said, "Victor, I'm going to give you a course in rhetoric in 10 minutes, and if you do it exactly the way I tell you to do it, the audience will think that you were born with a microphone in your hand." I said, but if you do anything like what you just showed me, I said, "You'll disgrace your mother." I said, "The audience will mill restlessly, and they'll slowly edge to a seat closer to the door." Learned it instantly. I said, "Victor, only say two or three words and then throw hesitation in your voice." I said, "There are ways to do that." I said, "But forget, we don't have time. Just every two or three words, a little hesitation in your voice, like that." And sometimes when you complete a sentence, Victor, I said, "Let two or three beats go by before you start the next one." And just stuff like that, which I learned in third grade in a Jesuit seminary in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where I was beaten almost every day because I wouldn't eat the beets that they grew at the seminary. I wouldn't eat beets anyway, and even if you beat me. Would you take a look at the newspaper model that you have? None of it is dummied up. None of it is the result of foundation grants or collegiate expertise. All of those things are real. Almost all of them were generated by the kids. The three girls who were the best writers in the class rewrote all the stories so that it would have the same tone in each of them, because we had a secondary purpose. I said, if you can get yourself in three newspaper articles, it's not an accident that this paper is laid out a lot like the New York Times there, because if you cut these things out and paste them up, nobody knows these came from a school newspaper. So if you have three of these, I said, it's a college scholarship, it's a summer job. I said, it's big advantages, and private school kids more or less are taught these things, that you document who you are. I taught the kids how to build a resume backwards. You start with the only point of a resume. I know that it causes great grief in many lives, and it caused it in mine. But a guy in the Princeton admissions office told me 20 years ago, he said, the only point of a resume is to show that you can handle responsibility. And the more different kinds of responsibility, and it's a throwaway when people put it down as if it didn't matter. Let me tell you something, that a balanced human being will have a physical hobby, they'll have a social hobby, and they'll have an intellectual hobby. Not basketball, football, swimming, ta-da, but basketball, chess, long-distance hiking. That you show with your hobbies what you do when your time's your own. All the rest of the stuff is when you're under the direction of some adult or official. But what you select on your own, he said, is utterly decisive. And if you show through that line that you don't know how to use your own time, he said, I can tell you this, we don't want you at Princeton. And why should you want a person like that? I mean, I'm being a little bit strong and heavy-handed here, when it's so easy to develop these different aspects, which I think are universal to all of us. Okay, if you take 5 minutes free from my voice and a breath for yourself and leaf through this newspaper, you will see a variety of undertakings that the class was doing in a 6-week period. And many of them aren't in here. We only print all the news that fits, we print. And then maybe afterwards, you guys can talk and ask me what it is that you're particularly interested in. Meanwhile, huh? Oh, there must be. There's a copy for everybody who's here, but they're not with me. They're with one of the people in the back of the room. You can have my copy here. But then what will I... I have two copies. I have two. See the boy and the girl on the lower right hand, page 3. That's 5 a.m. in the morning at the Port Authority bus terminal, which next to the wholesale food market in New York City has to be the second most dangerous place in the United States. They're leaving on a bus. I'm not putting them on the bus. Their mother's not putting them on the bus, but my wife is putting them on the bus. They're leaving on a bus for Albany, New York, where 3 hours later, they'll step off the bus and they will notify their state representative that they're in town to see what he does for his constituents. He does not know they're coming. That's him in the first column on page 3. And they said to me, well, what if he won't talk to us? Or won't see us? And I said, well, then you'll get on a bus and you'll come back to New York City. About 2 years ago, someone said to me, oh, do you know what happened to Jason Weinberg? He's the fellow who's grinning. Judy Trescott, I ran into her mother on a Broadway bus, and she said, you know, Judy, who couldn't speak, did you ever run into girls like that? Guys, too, who are absolutely mute. They cannot speak, period. They can speak one-to-one, but in a classroom setting, they can't talk. She said, Judy just got out of law school. She said, going to Albany, it changed her life. Not all at once, but bit by bit, she just threw that personality away. They were invited to go over and address the New York State Senate. They were taken out to dinner. And you know what would have happened if you had asked permission to go in advance. Permission denied. That's right. Okay. I've got to have this. Yes. Here's what happened to Jason Weinberg. That's some local New York, throwaway rag. But publicity whiz Jason Weinberg, flanked by one of his clients, Israeli supermodel, Mishaela, whatever. Jason, not a bad way to earn your living, Jason. And Judy's a lawyer, so when Jason gets in trouble, as you and I know he will, do you see anything in those papers that you'd like to ask about or comment about? There's really some revolutionary stuff there. At a time when the local Democratic clubs of the Upper West Side of Manhattan had announced that after a month-long voter registration drive, they could only get 500 votes because there was tremendous voter apathy. And my kids said, well, why is there voter apathy? I said, there isn't. I said, if you owned all the jobs, would you want new people to register in your party who might change the direction the party was going in? And they said, that can't be true. And I said, well, I'm going to declare a 2-day school holiday. Why don't you go out and register people yourself on the west side of Manhattan? And as you'll see on the first page of the newspaper, in 2 days, my kids registered 1,000 voters. But in the sign-ups on the street run by the local political clubs for a month, only 500 voters signed up. One kid said, a woman opened a window up high up in a building and screamed. Are those voter registration forms? In New York City, they're huge and they're like orange, orangish, so there's nothing else looks like them. She said, I'm coming right down. And he said, one of the kids said, the guy was talking on a payphone on the street. He threw the phone down and ran over and said, give me one of those. You might wonder why they're so desperate to get one. To get one right away, you have to travel to a single location in Manhattan that's extremely remote. It's, I think, on 10th Avenue and 26th Street. And then it's on the 10th floor of a building, and no employee in the building, as far as I could see, is under 75 or 80. So they're not really anxious to, I mean, it's the final payoff for a life badly lived, I guess. Is there anything there that, or even if it isn't in the paper, yes, sir. A lot of different ways is the answer. When you're determined to do it, whatever works, works. For example, if a particular kid is a tremendous pain, you never go through the authorities. Never, never, never. In no instance. You go to the other teachers and you say, would you mind if Jason Weinberg isn't in the class for a few days? Nobody ever says, oh, I'd mind terribly. Now, occasionally, I mean, there are a lot of different ways. I'll show you some of them. Occasionally, if you say, would you mind if the class didn't show up for the next couple of days, you very, very seldom. You say they're doing a project at Columbia University with the retired professors, which, by the way, is a live possibility for you. They're desperate for something to do. Often they're the best people in the department or the heads of the departments, and there can't be a college that doesn't have a retired professor's chapter. I mean, my kids had keys to the astronomy thing. You know, you look at Carl Sagan's ridiculous idea that there are millions and millions of worlds where people live or something lives. Another way to do it is to actually, if you think of the politics of schooling, nobody at all who's visible has any positive power to change the system. That includes the principal, the superintendent. They have negative power to put drag on things that would change the system. The positive power, a lot, it's almost all rhetoric. But notice that just as the government in ancient Sparta had no power at all. I mean, they put on these shows for the boobs, and if you knew who the E4s were, or if you read Hobbes' Leviathan, you could figure out where the E4s were. I tried to figure out who, in fact, was calling the shots in the schools, if they wanted to. And I was able to establish layers and layers. Gee, I should have brought, I had a pack of file cards with. One of them would be the politics of schooling to be a list of about 14 power bases, but I can remember enough of them. The local business community is much, much more important than your superintendent. Now, you got to know, it's not the local business community. What does that vast generalization mean? There will be businesses that are constantly active in the school because they sell the straws or a variety of other products. They keep an eye on the schools. Those people are extremely vulnerable to an interesting project to do. And once they say, yeah, would like to do that, or would like to take in your kids as an apprentice one day a week, I guarantee you there's not a principal or superintendent in the United States would dare to even think about saying no. If you have a local university with political clout, and of course Columbia was just a few blocks from me, there is not the instance where something requested on a Columbia letterhead would in fact be denied by a local school district. And I'm sure Boston's full of colleges that have similar clout to that. a constant resource that I had reference to was parents. It's very difficult to reach parents, but I would start each school year and actually visit as many homes as I could, because that was done to me when I was in school in Pittsburgh. I would call, I would give information sessions, and I would hold a little party one day a week, a coffee and donuts party. I never got more than a third of the parents, but often I got that many of them would show up, and now I had a personal relationship. I would say that a group of 5, 6, 7 parents could bring any school in the country to its knees if they so chose, and the principal is well aware of that. So he will not choose, as long as he's not told too much about what you're doing. He doesn't want to know anyway. But they will not choose to deny those requests. Every once in a while, I would get a class for a year. Not often. I mean, I did this for about 21 years out of the 30 I taught. Maybe twice that happened. But then there were no restraints caused by other teachers there. So if you want to do it, you can do it. If you're the homeroom teacher, obviously nobody else really has the power to punish your kids, because even if they do, you're the one who enters the punishment on the record. You know, hey, hey, well, we won't go into that. Are there some other questions or comments on what you see there? This is meant to be an illustration that young kids are capable of anything, and furthermore, just because they're capable of it, it's not a reason to do it. The payoff is very, very quick. Doesn't happen right away. But 90 days after your kid has shouldered real responsibility, you're not talking to a kid any longer, really. You're talking to a human being of one or the other gender who looks you in the eye and doesn't want their time wasted.